Well, here we are.
Did you think that we were going to walk out and no one would be here? Do you have that moment ever when you do sign in?
It crosses my mind. Yeah, that happened. For sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, so I emailed Jeff a few days ago a list of topics. And I wanted him to say what was okay to talk about and what was not okay to talk about. So apparently it's okay to talk about Orange County.
Oh, yeah. Got it.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's okay to talk about the Edgar Awards, which you have a problem not winning. and it is okay to talk about Raymond Chandler.
Oh, yeah. I think so. Mm-hmm. How about you? What's taboo and what's not?
I'll talk about anything.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Should be good.
Yeah, absolutely. So who goes first? Okay. Why did you leave Orange County?
Why did I leave Orange County? Well, I had a good setup there. I was living in Laguna Canyon in a nice little house that was built up on pylons. A real steep house, very dramatic house. I wrote about it in Summer of Fear. When the wind blows and the house moves, that was my house. And when my second son was born, Tommy, in 2000, I just outgrew the place. I lost my writing room. It became his nursery, and I had to rent an apartment up the road in El Toro to write in because the house wasn't big enough for all of us. And I realized this isn't smart to be renting an apartment and paying a mortgage, so let's go find somewhere else. And we wanted to find a place that had more room and was a little quieter and not as touristy as Laguna, not as kind of frantic as Orange County can be. And so we moved down south to a little place called Fallbrook, which is in North San Diego County, and it is known as the avocado capital of the world. And that's where I live. Today is the avocado festival of Fallbrook. I'm missing that
avocado
right now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Gratitude.
So that's where I left.
Yeah. So it was not a creative decision. It was more of a practical decision. It wasn't that you were done writing about Orange County and you wanted to be in another part of California.
No, it wasn't that. Although when I went down there, Chris, I thought, you know, I hope that I'm not breaking my charm because I'd written maybe 10 books, 12 books, whatever it was, by that time. And they were all set in Orange County. When I moved, I thought, well, I hope I'm not, you know, closing the magic box by going to somewhere else, you know. And it took me 2 years of living down there before I wrote a San Diego-based book. My first San Diego-based book was written in, like, 2002, 2003. And I'll tell you something, it surprised me because it was so refreshing and so nice to write about a new place.
Was it?
Yeah, like it's you know, San Diego has its own discrete history, very different than Orange County's. Mm-hmm. Its society is different, you know, L.A., Orange County, San Diego, they're all very similar, but they're very different too, you know. And I thrived on that. I loved it. I thought, God, this is great. It's like I felt like Magellan, you know. I just discovered this new world, you know.
Right. And I want to talk about that. So I asked you if we could talk about San Diego and what it means to write a novel about San Diego, because my mother lived in La Jolla for about a year, and my next novel has a town in it called Cathedral Beach, which is remarkably similar to La Jolla. Cold Pursuit, and also sort of at the end of Silent Joe, you have Joe go to Fallbrook.
That's right.
It's like you're sort of dipping your toes out of Orange County and sort of exploring. But I did a panel recently with Don Winslow, who I believe you might know.
Oh, yeah, I know Don.
San Diego. And we talked about the fact that San Diego is such a dismissed city in California. And there's like a raft of Raymond Chandler quotes just heaping bile on San Diego. I can't remember exactly, but he called it the harbor, nothing but a harbor full of boats and little else, you know.
Yeah.
And Don Winslow says that because Raymond Chandler chose to be buried in San Diego, he goes to the grave and dismisses Raymond Chandler. Do you do the same thing, or do you, you know, have some, you know, soft spot for San Diego?
Yeah, I do have a soft spot for San Diego. It's the same soft spot that you have for New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to like New Jersey because New Yorkers look down their noses at New Jersey, and it's the same. You know, and I was prepared for that being an Orange County guy because Orange County was traditionally sort of the Jersey to Los Angeles. You know, so if Orange County is like second fiddle to L.A., then San Diego is like third fiddle.
Right?
And I like that. I don't mind the fact that it's an underdog city. It is a very different place, though. It is a very unusual place. It's not like any place else I've been. Very fascinating history and an interesting kind of mix of people and powers that be in San Diego. It's a very different place than Los Angeles. And I like those kind of off the beaten track places a little bit. You know, that's why when I read Light Before Day and the very first scene takes place in Avenal.
Avenal.
Avenal. I mean, you guys know where Avenal is? It's like, you know, you're zooming up to five and Los Banos, and then there's Avenal. You know,
I found it by accident. You got to go over this little ridge. I think they call it the Kettleman Hills.
Yeah,
and it's
just
there, and it's about this big, you know.
Uh-huh.
And apparently there's a prison there, but I didn't know it was there when I found the town. I just said, this place is so weird. City Hall looks like a doctor's office.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, I was looking for a place that a woman would hide, and Avenal was it.
Perfect.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I like the off the beaten track stuff. San Diego's not that, of course. It's a full blown city, but it's fantastically different and kind of fun.
Yeah, it has a kind of political corruption going on that reminded me of New Orleans a bit, which
mm-hmm.
was strange because on the surface it seems a much cleaner and more conservative city than New Orleans ever has been. But then it had this sort of wild, sort of politicians were all sort of going out at night, and I guess there was a big scandal around strip clubs, right? They were
mm-hmm.
taking kickbacks from strip clubs.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A ton of that. And when I moved down there in 2000, I started subscribing to the Union Tribune, which is the only show in town in San Diego as far as daily papers go. And just amazing. Every day it was just this cornucopia of material. You know, I just like take the front page, take it out to my office, and put it in a stack because I knew that I'd use one of the front page stories like the next day in my writing.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
And the Strippergate scandal and Randy Cunningham. I mean, just parties and terrible abuse of the public trust. I mean, these people are elected people for crying out loud,
right.
And they're out there spending our tax money on hookers. I mean, just unbelievable stuff. You know, while he's married and he's got a family. You know,
right?
God, buddy. Thanks a lot, you know.
But do you think it's this thing with corruption where it's going on in every city? There are only certain cities where they're dumb enough to let us know about it.
Yeah.
And slip up.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that was the thing in New Orleans. It's just no one could be bothered to hide it. They were just having too much fun, you know. Like,
yeah.
And I got the same kind of sense about San Diego, too. But that leads me to another question I was going to ask you, which is, do you use the newspaper? You know, I was telling you backstage that I had the privilege of teaching or sort of reading course for MFA students at Otis last semester, and we read Summer of Fear,
mm-hmm.
and they loved it. But I would have them bring in the California section of the LA Times, and we would spend the last hour of the class. They would have to pick an article that got their juices flowing. I didn't get more specific than that. I didn't say come up with a full-fledged novel idea based on, you know, an article. But, you know, and it really worked. I mean, they really took to it. And I think among crime writers, it's a very popular tool that we use.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it's one that you use, too.
Yeah, I got a nice clip file in my office that I've been carting around with me for all of the 22 years that I've been publishing, and it's almost 6 feet high
really?
Now, and it's just newspapers, just the sheet with the article, not the whole paper, you know, and magazines and in-flight magazines and bar napkins I've scribbled on, and it's yay high, and it's mostly newspapers, to tell you the truth, you know, and
right.
that's how I'll jumpstart my imagination when it comes to write a new book, you know, when I'm
right.
completely done with whatever book I'm working on and it's out of my head, I'll grab that clip file, and I'll just start going through and looking at the articles and the notes that I've made over the past year and the past years, and that's often where I'll go, oh yeah, that's so fascinating. I really want to use that now. Like in the new book, Storm Runners, there's kind of three big characters in that book, and one is a guy who I grew up with in Tustin, who became a cop, an L.A.
Mm-hmm.
cop, and at Tustin High he was a drum major in the band. He led the band. And the other guy was a fellow that I never met, but I grew up adjacent to in Orange County named Joe Razzo, who was a bright, young Latino fellow who was in my clip file because he was sent to Harvard on a full ride, a scholarship, and when he came home, he went there for 2 years, and he had a B-plus average. He studied business. And when he came home on holidays and summertime, he committed armed robberies for
mm-hmm.
fun. And they finally caught him. And so Joe is in my clip file. And another thing in my clip file was an old article that I pulled out of a San Diego paper about Charles the Rainmaker Hatfield,
mm-hmm.
one of the famous rainmakers at the turn of the 20th century who plied his trade in San Diego. So that file is really valuable to me. All
yeah.
my good stuff goes in there, you know.
Yeah.
You have the same thing?
I go through the California section of the LA Times online, and I will usually cut and paste.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah.
It's the 21st century way, I guess, of doing it. But there's also something about having a hard copy of them that feels more permanent.
So do you keep yours on the hard drive then?
It's
always in the computer.
Yeah. And every now and then, if it's a real humdinger, I'll print it out and put it in a folder. But
mm-hmm.
what I find is that, or the way it started to happen with me, because I didn't start writing that way from a clip file, but I would see something usually on the news that was so disturbing it would eventually work its way into my work.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be a hole in something I was working on, and I would go, what about that story I read about the drug dealer who deliberately infected all of his clients with HIV, you know, made mm-hmm. these young women, you know, and I got to work it out some way, mm-hmm. so it just sort of bubbles up.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's something I rely on much more regularly. But I was going to ask you, do you turn to that clip file in desperation, or do you wait to write the stories that are in the clip file?
Yeah, I kind of wait. You know, yeah. Sometimes it's desperation. I don't know how you are, but for me, the hardest part of making a novel is before you start writing. You know, that gestation period, I guess you'd call it. You know, between the time when my mind is free to go about writing a new book and the time that I actually start, you know, write the first sentence, say, that's typically, you know, months. I mean, two, three months. And that can get a little bit long and a little bit scary when the ideas aren't coming and aren't happening. Like right after 9/11, you know, I'd sent out my final copy edited manuscript back to New York on September the 10th. I'd overnighted it that, and oddly enough, it got to its destination on the 11th. Believe it or not, 9/11. But anyway, just as saying, I was completely done at that point with that novel,
right.
And now it's time to write a new one. And 9/11 had just happened, and I, like a lot of people, I went for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks just staring at the screen, just going, why should it, what can I write? Why, what's my response to this going to be? You know, how can I possibly deal with this, you know?
Right.
Did you go through that?
I had a manuscript that I was copy editing, and the last scene was in a fictional apartment building about two blocks from Ground Zero.
Oh.
So I remember going in that day and having to cross out all the references to the World Trade Center and the spire of the World
Trade Center. No kidding.
And I remember thinking, wow, what a gruesome, it's a gruesome finish to this book. It's the Snow Garden. And I remember thinking, God, is this scene going to fly? You know, and I think that was a little arrogance on my part because people weren't looking to my book to define the 9/11 experience for them, but it was really odd. It was mm-hmm. a frightening thing for me. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking that because crime writers usually pump out a book a year, mm-hmm. that they were going to be the first ones, and because of what the genre obviously entails, who had to incorporate some sense or had to address 9/11 and mm-hmm. the feelings it raised, particularly in first responders, right away. And I remember, I think, Michael Connelly's City of Bones came out not long afterwards, and I remember it was the first mention he has them go to a bone expert who works at the La Brea Tar Pits, and mm-hmm. he talks about having worked at Ground Zero, and it was real quick.
Yeah, that's
when that
right.
came out,
that's right.
You know?
Now, what did that do to your the next book? So you're pretty much done. You're copy editing that one. So what?
Yeah.
What did 9/11 do to your to the next one? Was it hard to get past that?
No, I think because I knew the next one was going to be sort of about an amateur detective. It wasn't about a cop. It was going to be about writers. And I think it provided some kind of inspiration in that. I don't know, it's a hard question to answer because there were whole conversations that were in the book between the two main characters in Life Before Day, kind of about 9/11, that I cut because they were kind of preachy and inappropriate, but mm-hmm. they were my attempt to kind of work through
mm-hmm.
it. You know, and there was this, the attitude was that Life Before Day is about an established mystery writer and an amateur detective kind of team up. And the writer was saying, look, conspiracy theories often come true. You know, we have been the victim of a sort of massive plot that took years to plan. And, you know, this is something he uses as a defense of himself when the amateur reporter is saying, you're overreacting. This
mm-hmm.
is not how crime
mm-hmm.
develops. Crime is instantaneous. It's about rash split second decision. He's saying, no, you know, there are dark forces at work in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but ultimately those conversations just
go to the story. That dovetails. Yeah, you don't need to have those conversations, really.
Yeah,
it's in there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So let's get the annoying processy questions out of the way.
Do I outline?
Yeah.
Oh, I have outlined in great detail, and I've also outlined not at all.
Mm.
I've done it both ways. I have a good outline story, I'll tell you. Six years ago, Hyperion, my publisher, said, we want an outline for this next book of yours. It sounds complicated, and we want an outline. We want a good outline, too. Said okay, so I wrote him an outline, and as you know, writers always write outlines sort of tongue in cheek because how do you outline something that doesn't even exist yet?
Sure.
So I wrote the outline. I was very, very assiduous about it, and I wrote a 90-page, single-spaced outline for Red Light, the novel that became Red Light, and I mailed it to him, and they waited, of course, and held it upside down or whatever they do, and said, "Oh yeah, this is great, love it." And so I wrote it, and I got stuck on page 250 about manuscript page. I thought, ooh, this book's going south here in a hurry. I can feel it. This is bad. What's wrong? I thought about it, and I couldn't figure out what should happen next and why this book wasn't working. So I said to myself, well, look at the outline, Jeff. So I went and I got the outline, and I found my place in the story on the outline, the 90 pages, And there it was. There was my answer. There was the solution to my problem was right there. So, leap forward a year. I got another book that I've hatched out and I've told them about. It's called Silent Joe and it's about this guy, blah, blah, blah. They say, oh, well, write us an outline just in case you get stuck again. You know? I go, okay. So I write him this whopping outline. It's a 70-page, single-spaced outline for Silent Joe, you know. Mail it to them. They weigh it, hold it upside down, shake it, say, okay, write the book. So I start writing the book and page 250, I'm stuck again. You know? I go, oh, my God, this book's going south. Go to the outline. So I get the outline, and I find my place in the story on the outline, and I read what's supposed to happen next. I realize the outline is just a complete disaster. I mean, if I'd have followed that outline, I'd still be trying to finish that book. You know, it's just like the wrong thing. You know, so long story short, I mean, there's good outlines and there's bad outlines, and obviously, no outline is probably better than the bad outline.
Yeah.
How about you?
I did an outline for this last book, and then I started writing the book, and I threw out the middle of the outline.
Yeah.
You know, the whole middle chunk of the book.
Yeah.
It didn't work at all. But somehow it made sense on the little note cards, because it got the note cards next to one another, but you don't write a book in note cards. I think, you know, I like David Morrell.
Yeah.
Has a book that he wrote. He's a professor of writing at Iowa for many years, and he said he does this thing called a dialogue with himself. He gets a little out there with it, but he gives his computer kind of a name. And he writes this sort of, it does a kind of conversation with God thing with the computer where, hi David, how are you feeling together? What do you feel like writing today? And he generates this sort of almost psychiatrist conversation about this book. But he says what it does is that at the end of 5 days, he's got enough to talk about if he has to go into a meeting on this book.
He's already talked about it. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's cool.
So it's not, I tried it and it didn't really work for me.
Yeah.
You know. I'll try anything in that build-up period. You know, I'll try anything.
Did you outline the one that you were referring to because you were asked by your editor, or was that just for yourself? You thought it would be good to outline the book?
It was just for myself, and I think I wanted to give it a real try. Because what I had done with outlines previously is I get up to a certain point, I just ditch it, and I say, you can't plan this much.
No, you can't think ahead that many steps.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I remember on California Girl, that was 2004, and when I went to write that book, for the first time, I was going to have, you know, I was going to have multiple protagonists,
right,
and multiple viewpoints, and I knew that the story would take place over 40 so years rather than the 8 days that usually takes my story. So I knew that I had a really complicated thing on my hands if I was going to pull it off right. So I thought, you know, son of an engineer that I am, I got out the graph paper and I sharpened the pencils and I said, well, I'm going to outline the bejesus out of this thing. I'm going to build this thing in advance, you know.
Right.
And I looked at it and I got my pencil and I thought, well, 40 years, four brothers, you know, incorrectly solved crime is finally, you know, the truth comes out in 2004. And I thought, nah, screw it. And I threw the pencil away and the graph paper, and I sat down, sans outline. I didn't have one sentence about that book written, and I wrote it one sentence at a time, trying to keep all of those elements alive and accounted for as I wrote. And that was the most exciting and most fun book I've ever written.
Is it really?
It was a ball. It's a great way to work.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was terrified to begin that book, but it worked. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was fun.
Well, now, was it just because you just dove in like that, or was there something else that contributed to that process of making it that enjoyable?
The subject matter was dear to my heart. It's kind of about my boyhood in a way, my early days in Orange County as a teenager. The focal year in that book is 1968, and I was 14 then, I think 14 years old. And, you know, 14-year-olds are amazing people because their brains are fully developed, even though they have almost no experience in the world, you know. I mean, their senses are alive. You can read the paper and you can hear the news. You can hear, you know, see the TV about Vietnam, and you can hear Nixon talking at you, and you can hear your parents arguing and drinking and whatever they're doing, you know. But you're just a kid. You don't have anything to bounce it off of. You have no perspective at all, you know. So my 1968... as a 14-year-old growing up in Orange County was a year of staggeringly big characters and events to me. I felt dwarfed by the world in a good way, you know. And to go back many, many, you know, years later and try to remember that time and create into it and from it was it was wonderful. I thought I was doing what a writer ought to do. I felt I felt tasked to do that.
Yeah.
In a good way. Yeah.
Yeah. Was it a book you had been waiting to write for many years?
Yeah. I didn't think I could pull it off or get away with it.
Right.
Yeah, I could never have written that book in 1985 when I wrote Laguna Heat.
Okay.
I couldn't have written it in 95. It took me 20 years to get to the point where I could write that book. And also, I had a real blessing, too, because that book had been knocking around inside of me a little bit over the years, and my agent had just moved me from one publisher to another. we weren't really getting along too well anymore. And he moved me, and he took me to a new publisher, and he took me to the new publisher with the agreement that I would write for them two books, the first one of which would be a book featuring the odd woman out detective in Orange County, Mercy Rayborn, whom I'd written about three times before. I had sort of a trilogy going, written about this woman three times. And that was the contractual agreement with Morrow. And so I signed the papers, and they signed the papers, and we all had the love fest that you have when you find a new publisher, and they really like you and stuff. And then Marjorie, I'm talking to Marjorie, my new editor, on the phone, and she had wanted to publish me for like 20 years since she'd read Laguna Heat. She was fabulously happy to have me. And she says, well, what are you going to write for me? I said, well, the contract calls for a Mercy Rayborn novel, so I guess that's what I'll write you. And she goes, well, is that what you would like to write me? And I said, no. And she says, well, what would you like to write? And I pitched her California Girl, and she just said, write it. See you later, man.
Wow.
Yeah, and not every editor would have said that. A historical, multiple viewpoint, sort of generational mystery, but, you know, maybe not a, you know, a tough book, a tough sell in a lot of ways. And she was brave, and I'll owe that book to her forever. Because I think a lot of editors just would have said, forget it. Write the Mercy Rayborn, and we'll talk in a year.
Yeah, absolutely.
You like editors? Do you have good ones?
I just switched too, and I'm in the love fest period.
The love fest, great. Yeah, write it out.
Yeah, my line edits are coming back in about a couple days, so we'll see how long that love fest lasts. But yeah, no, it's interesting, because I'm going from a very hands-on editor to a very kind of hands-off edit. Well, I should see those line edits before I say that. But very sort of, I'm getting more latitude. And it's a little scary. A little scary. But the switching publishers is scary.
It is scary, yeah.
But it's been a good move for you, you think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a good move. They're a good publisher.
Yeah.
I trust my agent a lot. I don't know how you feel about agents. I'd like to know. But the guy that I have, I had three agents. Not because I'm prickly or hard to get along with, it just sort of worked out that way. But this guy's my third, and I'll never get another one. I mean, as long as he's alive, I'll be loyal to him. Plus, he's a great agent, and I look to him for that kind of guidance, because I'm not really a very sagacious businessman, and I don't know what's going on in New York. I don't know which publishing houses and which editors and publishers are kind of ascendant, and which ones are kind of on hard times, and who the up and comers are, and all that stuff. I rely on Robert Gottlieb to do that for me, and he's great at it. That's his world. Yes. He lives for that stuff. And when Robert says, "Look, it's time to go," then I trust him. I just say, "Sorry, guys, we're leaving." And he says, "Look, you know, you got to stay, because I can take you out there, but I cannot get you a better deal than you've got right now with this publisher. So stay put." Then I'll stay put. You know. So I don't know. Can you trust your people like that?
I can trust them. I'll tell you what I learned from my agent is that agents are not the place to go for creative enthusiasm.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not trying to disparage agents, but it's sort of not their job. But they're not going to tell you up front, "This isn't my job."
Yeah.
You know, you give them something to read, and they say, "Oh, well, it's so interesting." You know, or, you know, it was very frightening, you know, and you get those sort of comments out of them, because I love my agent very dearly, and she's also my mother's agent, you know, and so I have sort of a long family history with her, but she gets the bottom line, you know, and I can't expect much else from her. I think that's why I really value my relationship with my editor, and I think also why it's important, and I don't know if you do this, but to develop the circle who read the manuscript, the personal circle with people. You know, who will tell you what's going on.
Yeah, who's your circle?
Well, I have my friend Eric, who's here. Where are you, Eric? Yes. He reads it for me. It used to be my father before he passed away. He read my first book and said, "You got to do something with this." And it's not my mother.
No.
She reads it last. And I think that's easy for her, too, because I think that she doesn't feel the compulsion to edit her baby's work, because she would.
Sure, yeah.
And there's sort of a maybe a third that needs to be worked in there, but maybe not. I think I got a good crew.
Is the agent obviously one of that circle? I mean, first reads or not?
No.
Really?
No.
Really?
Oh. Yeah.
And then not editor either?
No, my editor is the first read.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's how it worked out with this one, because I said, if I give you, are you able, because the way the business is right now, some editors don't want to read a first draft. They want to read a third draft. You know, I have a writer friend who hires his own editor in Brazil to edit his novel. The guy just lives in Brazil. It's not like that makes him a special editor. But he has the novel edited before he gives it to his editor in-house.
Interesting.
And so I asked this new editor, I said, "What's the beef? If I give you something that's rough, will you accept it as something that's rough?" and not start giving me notes on the color of the character's jacket when I need to talk structure with you. And he said, yeah, I'll go that way with you. You know, and so I'm in Scribner now, and I actually have an editor who's not a Scribner editor. He's editing for them, which is sort of how they work. And there's something really comfortable about that arrangement.
Cool.
For me.
Good.
So, yeah. Well, let's talk some about Stormrunners. Because you went after water.
I went after water.
Kind of not the Chinatown thing. I'm sure you've heard that by now. But it's literally about a woman who's figured out a way to make rain, which makes the DWP very, very angry at her.
Yeah.
And public works, in general, sort of weave their way through a lot of your books. Your Silent Joe's about the toll roads, really. You know, all that sort of stuff. Is that sort of a Southern California obligation, if you're going to write, you know, crime fiction down here? Is that sort of the thing that ties us together?
I think so. I think so. I don't seem to be able to get away from it, you know. The toll roads in Orange County, you know, the water in Los Angeles. Civic improvement projects. You know, I think they're endlessly fascinating, and that I think they kind of define who we are as a people. You know, this is what we spend our money on. We build aqueducts and dam rivers and make make reservoirs and transport water 250 miles to build a metropolis in the desert, basically. And I think that's fantastic stuff. You know, it's hard to ignore it. You know, in the East, when I go to New York, say, or Boston, it doesn't seem like they're, maybe because it happened so much longer ago, it doesn't seem like their confrontation with nature is nearly as fresh as ours. You know,
right.
It's like big city, the city's won, you know,
right.
And out here it still feels like, you know, big flood could, you know, a tsunami or something could wipe us out. I feel a little more tentative here than I do in the East, you know.
Right.
And so anyway, I was trying to get at that a little bit. I mean, I think the whole idea, I love rain. As a Westerner, you have to love rain, you know. But I love the rain that we don't get.
Right.
You know, yesterday was a wonderful day before. But I think that if you actually could make rain, that would bring you, you'd sit like just this far below God himself. I mean,
right.
If you could actually make rain. And there were these guys at the turn of the century, 20th century, Charles Hatfield being one of them, who was in my clip file that I mentioned, who was a rainmaker. And he had spectacular successes as a rainmaker. And he had a secret formula, and he would build these towers. And 1916, the city of San Diego hired him to make rain for them because they were drought-ridden. It was a six-year drought, and they had just built Balboa Park, beautiful park, and they were going to host the Pan American Exhibit of 1917, which was intended for the world to come to San Diego and see that if you wanted to invest in the West, in the New World, you didn't come to Los Angeles. You came to San Diego. And they built this beautiful park to show off San Diego. It was the whole idea. And then, but they hadn't had any rain, and all the exotic plants and trees started to wilt, and the town was becoming a dust bowl because the Marina Reservoir was all but empty by late 1916, and the desperate city council hired Hatfield. They brought him in, and they said, we want you to give us 40 inches of rain before the end of March, because April is when the people are going to start coming.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the average annual rainfall in San Diego is 9. Okay? So they wanted 40 inches. And they said, in 3 months, right now, starting right now. And he said, they said, can you do it? And he said, yes, I can do it, and I will do it. It'll cost you $10,000, and I won't charge you $1 until the 40th inch of rain falls. And they said, okay, go do it. So him and his brother went up to the mountains around San Diego, and they built these towers, and they put these big canisters in the towers, and they lit these fires under them, and they put in their secret chemicals. This is like December the 28th, 1916, and the chemicals wafted up into the sky, and then they waited. 2 or 3 days later, it started raining. And raining, and it rained, 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 and it rained. The 40th inch fell a month later by the end of January. He had the 40 inches, but then it kept raining. Marina Reservoir flooded, killed a bunch of people, killed a bunch of cows, wrecked a bunch of farmland, destroyed half the city. The only thing left was Balboa Park, back of it. And it kept raining. And he got 52 inches of rain fell that season. Well, by far a record that's never been equaled, all because Hatfield apparently caused an effect, right? Because Hatfield sent his chemicals up there. And the funny part was San Diego City Council said, let's not pay him, let's lynch him. And truly, and happy, typical San Diego, you know.
Yeah,
that's why the headlines are so good. And so Hatfield had to flee to Orange County, and then afterwards to Los Angeles to stay ahead of the lynch mob in San Diego, who wanted to hang him for giving him 52 inches of rain that year. So anyway, rain. I love the stuff. And coincidentally, I think while I was writing Storm Runners was 2 years ago, which was our big winter. Remember the giant rainfall that we had three seasons ago, 2 years ago. And in my little place in Fallbrook, my little farm in Fallbrook, we got 37 inches of rain that year. And our average is like 13. So anyway, I love that natural stuff.
Absolutely.
I think it's great.
Pacific Bee, too. Environmental concerns all through that. It's basically about the Newport Harbor, right?
Yeah, Irvine Company.
Mm-hmm. And there's just an amazing speech that you have. You sort of towards the end of the novel, there's this sort of, and you'll have to tell me if it was based on a real figure, but this environmentalist activist comes into this nightclub and makes the speech to them, which ends with, "We are not in need of being saved, we are in need of being decent."
Yeah.
Which I just thought
Thank
was
you.
Like a home run. You know, where are you at today with what's going on with Al Gore and Inconvenient Truth? Because you just seem, you don't see the grandstand on the issue, but it's always a theme in your books.
Yeah, always
what
a theme.
We're doing to the environment, what the environment's doing to us.
I've changed a little bit, I think, Chris. I think as a young man, I was outraged, if you will, about what had happened, what I'd seen happen in Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not outraged by that anymore. I think people are just people, and you chop down the groves, and you build houses, and you go put the groves up somewhere else, sort of, more or less, you know. I think we need responsible planning and all that stuff, but I no longer consider human beings to be a scourge. I'm not so sure that human beings are less important than oranges, you know. So
right.
I'm not outraged about it anymore. But the bigger questions, though, like that, I mean, you know, greenhouse gases and how we conduct our business and our lives on Earth in a way that may be profoundly destructive. That's another story. You know, I don't feel that for me, and I'd like to know what you think. For me, as a novelist, I've yet to see crime writer. I've yet to see anything in Al Gore that I can use. I can't see the micro story. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean the big stuff. Yeah, I can see the movie and go, oh wow, yeah, and the figures and all that stuff. But you know, to bring it down to the specifics of an orange grove being destroyed, it's much easier to do that than to deal with, you know, greenhouse gases. I don't know what would.
I love the movie. I think greenhouse gases are terrible. I walked away wanting more personal information about who he was, and everyone had said, oh, it wouldn't have been appropriate, and everybody would have thought it was a presidential run. But there's a little piece of him talking about the death of his sister.
I remember that.
Lung cancer.
I remember
they were
that.
Tobacco farmers, or his father was,
I think,
if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the beginning of something for me, you know. That was some illumination too, but I was hungry for more of that. And you're right, it's not enough for me to tell a story about him yet.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, me neither. Yeah.
Yeah, he's not a noir figure to me.
Al Noir.
But you know what, I want to talk about, that's another sort of obligatory question, the noir question. I contributed a short story to Los Angeles Noir, which just came out a few weeks ago, and we've been doing a lot of group events that have been a real blast. But of course, the question is, what is noir? What does it mean? And the course that I taught at Otis, we wrestled with a bunch of definitions all semester long, and we never really settled on one, but I did a panel with Susan Strait, who I believe you know,
mm-hmm.
Who wrote High Wire Moon, and she said that, you know, if all California writing, not just noir, in some sense is united by this sense of diminished expectations, you know, that people move here with big dreams, and they're very rarely met, and the fall from that is big, and that the characters who make that fall or who are on that fall, that's noir. What do you think?
God, you would have to ask me that. I don't know. I would have thought about it and maybe tried to prepare an intelligent answer if I knew that you had asked me. I don't know. I don't really get it. I mean, doesn't the term actually go back to French filmmakers?
Sure.
I mean, that's where it started, right?
I think
and it was
so.
Applied
I
to
film,
Western.
Maybe open it up to the audience if they know, but I think it was a film term.
I think it's a film term.
Yeah,
yeah, and it was later applied to our genre, if you will, mystery, Western mystery genre stuff. So it means black, is that right?
Yeah.
Noir's black. Well, I don't know. I mean, you go round and round on that one. But the thing that I think probably for me distinguishes it is there in noir for me there's kind of an acceptance and an expectation of disaster.
Right.
This story is going to end badly.
Right.
Is what I get out of it. You know.
Yeah.
And when I read noir fiction, and I see it coming like that, and that expectation mm-hmm. is met, the expectation of lowered expectation or of this story ending poorly, I feel personally as a reader that I'm reading something that is only partially helpful. You know, literature's big and it's wide, and noir is great, but there are more comprehensive ways to look at life mm-hmm. than that. And I think that we need to have books that address larger things than the almost comfortable, smug negativity that you can create sad little stories with. I think that those are fine, but there are bigger, better stories to tell, and I hope that I can track them down. California Girl is plainly not noir,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it contains a miracle. It actually contains a miracle, which is sort of impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Miracles are supposed to be impossible, but I put it in there because I believe in them. Maybe not literally, but I believe in them, and I think that sense of I think that there's humor and hope and just goofy enjoyment of life's moments.
Mm-hmm.
Short as our years are,
right.
that make a mockery of the idea that all stories end poorly mm-hmm. and that we all have to be sad and drink too much and chain smoke. I
yeah.
just don't fucking
right.
believe it.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I'm not a cheerleader.
Thank you for saying it. Thank you for saying it. I mean, because when I wrote this story, I really tried to follow the noir rules.
How'd it go?
It was dark, and I thought, I can't do this every time out.
I wouldn't want to either.
You know, the other stuff, it made me look back on my last book, which people said was noir. I thought, You know, it wasn't, like you're saying, it wasn't that smug. It didn't go to that dark a place. There was a redemptive ending
yeah.
to it. And I'm hungry for that redemptive ending,
you
and
too.
I agree. You know, I think people get lost in the palm trees and the shadows, and they think that all these sort of combination of stylistic elements adds up to noir, but it's really a negative state.
It is. It's a negative state
yeah.
of mind. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you are not noir.
I don't think so. You know, I've written some very dark, spooky books. I went through my sort of I call it my splatter period or my fright night period. I wrote the two scariest books that I could. You know, The Blue Hour, about the guy who's taken the female hormones as part of his chemical castration punishment and transforming into this killer, was the spookiest, creepiest thing I could think of. And then the book that was just before that was even worse. It was about this guy who's got these snakes, and he's a serial pedophile and violent,
and fly,
I just yeah. yeah, I just got into the grim, the darkest side of me that I could possibly dredge up, because I thought it was worth it. I thought I'm gonna do Fright Night. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna do two books of Fright Night, or however many is in me, and I don't repudiate those books or regret those books. I think there's some good stuff in them, but I could never write one now, because I don't believe that those books for me are necessary now.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Where does Summer of Fear fall in that continuum for you? Because Summer of Fear is a book of yours that a lot of people talk about, and it's
yeah.
one of my favorite of your books, because it's a serial killer thriller that's not a serial killer thriller.
No,
right?
It's not.
You know, I think everyone is. There's this consensus, particularly on the blogs about crime writing, that the serial killer thriller is over. You know, and has been for a while.
It has been, yeah.
But
yeah.
you have always worked serial killers into the framework of larger stories, and Summer of Fear is one of those stories.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's a very dark book, but in some odd way, I think that it ends hopefully in that after this terrible serial killer is caught and dealt with, and this terrible cancer that the writer's wife has is finally blatantly out of control, and she's
right.
doomed. They decide to go to forego further treatment and go down to Mexico and live out the rest of her short life. And to me, that is that's enough hope to get me through the day.
Right.
Yeah. And so to me, the book is hopeful, even though it ends in her death.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I. Switching gears. Mm-hmm. Are you really at your death by 7 in the morning?
Yeah, I am.
Oh, my
I am.
God.
I know, it's bad.
I'm out of here.
Well, Carl Hyacinth said the same thing to me. He said, well, you know, if you're at your desk writing at 7 in the morning, your stuff is going to sound like it was written by a guy at his desk writing at 7 in the morning.
Ouch. But that's the next question. Are you writing by 7, or is it about being there at 7? Is it about gearing up?
I'm usually writing by 7, Chris. I like to do that. I get up early, and I like to hit the office early, because for me, I don't know how it is for you, but for me, a day always becomes more complicated than getting less complicated. I mean, you have to go through a day that gets less complicated, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, more stuff happens, you know? And so you know, get there, and I don't check the email, and I don't hit the phone if the little light's flashing. You know, I turn on the screen, and I go back to what I wrote the day before, and I start reading it and making little corrections and stuff, and the next thing I know, I'm in that moment. And seriously, I'll get more work done between 7 in the morning and 8 o'clock when I knock off to walk my little boy out to his ride. We have a carpool. I'll get more done in that hour sometimes than I'll get done after 8 o'clock and through 4 o'clock or right. 5 o'clock. Yeah, just because it's clear and you're uncluttered and you're not trying to multitask and all that. And I feel good usually clear in the mornings. You know, too tired, too groggy to be afraid to do my job.
Self-critical,
you
know, yeah.
Just, yeah, it's self-critical, exactly. Right. You just sit down, you plunk yourself down, and you do it.
Right, and what do you call it quits?
I'm stubborn, and I work long hours. I'm out of the office by 5.
Wow.
Yeah, but it's not all writing, and you know that. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, there's research you need to do, and telephone, and you take a break for lunch, and you know, there's always something to do. So it's not all writing. But, you know, sometimes it can be close to all writing. What's a good day for you? What's like a banner day for pages?
Oh, 6 or 7.
Really?
Yeah, I think. But that's the place that I've worked to get to because I was so, in the last week, so self-critical. And so I would keep editing to the degree that I was shutting myself down every day. And I finally realized that. But really, I have to get out of the house before I start. I have to have contact with the world. You know, I get out, I go to the gym, I eat a meal at a restaurant, I get out. And then if it's like 2:30, 3 o'clock, I'm in panic that I haven't started yet. So if I start by 1, I'm good.
Wow.
I'm good. And the secret to answering this question is you don't tell when you stop, and so nobody knows how long you actually write for. But, I mean, that's really a good day. And part of that is about the limited time keeps me from hacking those pages apart. See, if I sit there too long, I start to go at them. You know, with the scalpel, before it's time to go at them, you know, and nothing gets produced each day.
So if you sit in that office long enough, you'll start to just chew on your own tail?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But, I'm always quizzing. Right. Oh, A and Q&A. Okay.
A and Q?
Some library tradition.
They got me,
So anyway, good. Well, we got this question set. So I guess we should go to Q&A then.
That's the past half an hour or 40 minutes or whatever.
How much time do we have left?
As much as we
Well, are there any questions?
I work till tomorrow morning.
Well, how late do you work? I'll ask you.
Okay.
I'll give you a cue. Yeah.
6:30. 7,
really?
Maybe.
So you're looking at 6 hours a day, 5-6 hours a day?
Is that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Not too bad, right?
Yeah. That's probably how much I write, write. I just might sit there longer, but yeah.
I don't know, I should be held accountable. Eric, do I really write for that long? Usually call him when I'm done.
No, I think it depends on the day.
Yeah.
Right? Some days you'll call at 10 o'clock at night, or what time did you finish this last game?
Yeah, it's about what part of the process I'm in, too. Mm-hmm. Maybe that changes for you, too. If it's a first draft, that's what I'm talking about, you know, when I'm, like, pulling it out. You know, but if it gets into revision mode, I can go for hours at a stretch if I feel like I'm just sort of moving the puzzle pieces.
Yeah, it's more like labor, kind of. Yeah.
Yeah, and so, absolutely. And then line edits, it's like I want them done as fast as possible.
Yeah.
You know. Are there any questions from the audience? Oh, there's someone.
This question is for, I have several questions, but this question is for Chris, because I don't know if you announced this or not, but your mother is Anne Rice. The very, very well-known author. And I'm curious about why and how you got started writing. Was it just something that fascinated you from the beginning, or what was your process to start writing? Because I remember seeing you early on at Spoken Interludes, and I didn't know who you were, but you read from your work, and I thought, wow, that guy can write.
Oh, thank you. You know, I wanted to be an actor, and I got to college, and nobody else wanted me to be an actor. So I was a freshman, and I had been the king of the pond at my high school in the theater department, and I really thought it was just going to continue. And, you know, I was a freshman in college. They weren't going to cast me. I didn't even get called back. But I thought, you know what? I'm going to show these guys, because nobody can stand in between me and that computer. You know, they cannot publish it. They cannot do anything with it, but they can't get it in between me and the computer. They can't interrupt the process the way they can with acting. So that's how it started, and I wrote a really terrible play. and another really terrible play, and some screenplays that were not so terrible. And I sort of cleansed my system of all this sort of youthful stuff. And I thought, oh, wow, I got bit. Now, I didn't think this was going to happen. For just that reason, I thought, this is Mom's deal. I can't do it. And I justified it to myself early on. I thought, okay, well, I'll just go after screenwriting. Because, you know, that will be easier. But, you know, but I won't, it's not, I mean, she'll have the novels and I'll have the screenplays. It's the kind of plans you come up with at 19 and 20.
Yeah.
And, you know, what happened is I went up to NYU. I went to their dramatic writing department. They weren't doing things the way I would have them do it, so I left after a semester. And I was asked to read something short at Spoken Interludes, because I was friends with Delaney Michelle, who used to run that series. And I wrote this short story that became... The way people responded to it at Spoken Interludes convinced me that there was more there. So I started pecking away at it. What happened is my mom got real ill. She had diabetes and she didn't know it. And I was living out here. So I went back to be with her in New Orleans, and I had left all my files here, whatever I was working with at the time, and I thought, well, I've got that short story. Let me, like, poke at it and see what might happen with it. And it just didn't stop. And what I had at the end was a very rough draft, but it was done, you know, and I had a hard time finishing, as a lot of writers who were starting out did. And that convinced me. What happened is then I gave it to my father to read, and he said, I mean, my father was a tough critic. You know, it didn't matter if you were his son. He was tough. He was a creative writing professor for years at San Francisco State. He was very clear about what he wanted. And he said, you need to do something with this. I'm not sure what's going to happen, but this is going to change your course.
Hmm.
So that's kind of how it went.
Well,
question for Jeff. 22 years later, you still write for the same reasons?
Yeah, pretty much so. Yeah, I enjoy the labor for the most part. I don't enjoy all of it, but I do get a kick out of writing a good sentence, and it gives me just enough, you know, it gives me just enough energy back to write, to try to write another one, you know, and ditto a good paragraph, and ditto a good chapter. You know, larger returns, and then by the time you get to the end of a manuscript that you're proud enough to put your name on, and you believe in, and you've worked hard to make it as good as you can, that's a good feeling. It's, I believe in what we do. It's a good feeling. People need stories. People need to be entertained, and people need to be engaged. And I think what we do is valuable. And so I feel good about it. Yeah, and that's essentially why I started writing, because I believe that writing is that storytelling is important, and I had a hunch as a young man that I could be adept and conversant in storytelling if I worked hard enough, and I think that's true, and I honor the job, if you will. You know, I take it seriously, and it's a great world to be a part of. You know, and all of that aside, I've made a good living at it, and I live well doing what I do, and I enjoy that. I mean, there's certainly other ways to make a living that are probably easier and more financially rewarding. But being a writer is dear to my heart. You know, I don't know how it really got into me, but it did. When I was in school, I think, you know, when I read literature, it just shut me up. It's just like, here you are in the presence of a great storyteller. You know, what more do you want? And so I'm, you know, monkey see, monkey do. I'm still trying to be a great storyteller.
What is a good sentence?
Stromzo was in high school when he met the boy who would someday murder his wife and son.
That's a good sentence.
I think it's a good sentence. It's a good opening sentence, certainly. I don't know. The list goes on and on. Mm-hmm. Why is Call Me Ishmael a great sentence?
Mm-hmm.
It just is. You have to read the next one.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. What do you think? What's a good sentence?
I think that's it. I think it's the tingle on the back of your neck.
Yeah. You know it when you see it. You do. And to actually write one, you go, ooh, here's a good sentence. Huh?
Absolutely.
You know, yeah, it's a good feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a question. Does it get easier? Harder thing?
Oh, you know, parts of it easier. I you know, I'm only a number four. That's the one I just turned into my agent. And what's gotten, I trust some of my instincts more. But I think what gets harder is that the voices get more numerous in your head. The critics' voices take on different, they wear different masks and they sound like different relatives and they get, you know, different bad reviews come back to haunt you. And that, shutting those, you have to, I had to get more sophisticated about how I close those out.
Interesting. You're talking about reviews, critics reviews?
Yeah, we could talk about it, yeah.
Talk about them.
Wow. You know, I don't want to. We found
there's,
the one thing I don't want to talk about. You know, we found the thing. You know, my process with reviews was interesting because everyone said, don't listen because they're going to hate you because you didn't write the Sun.
Yeah.
So just don't listen. But that's a blanket dismissal. I think there were some negative reviews of my first book that I took to heart, that I actually read, and I thought there was some constructive stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But I think it's a dangerous game because it becomes, writing to critics becomes its own occupation, which isn't really about writing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you agree? Like, and trying to please critics as if they were, people start to speak of them as if they're a single voice.
It's more complicated.
You know, they're much more fractured and subject to trends and, you know. What do you think?
Well, I think what you say is true. I don't know how you would write to please critics, you know. I mean, that's a whole other question. I mean, I sort of write to please myself, and because I think of myself as my audience. I think of myself as you guys. So I, you know, I'm your representative at the computer, if you will, you know. And I don't want it to get by me because I don't want it to get to you unless it's good. And that's about as deep as I get, and you know. Mm-hmm. I could no more write something that I knew would please critics than I wouldn't know how to do it, you know. I wouldn't know how to write a book that would make a good movie. I'm just not geared that way, you know. Reviewing of mysteries, of crime fiction, if you will, is not in a good state, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are very few reviewers of that genre, of our genre, who really know what they're talking about. I mean, very few of them have any historical perspective whatsoever. It's very hard to find thoughtful, intriguing, good reviews of, you know, book reviews. That's not true of all fiction. There's some good book reviewers out there. You know, the Times has got some, and the New Yorker's got some, and the New York Times has a few, and the Wall Street Journal has a few, and you can find them. There are good book critics out there, and you learn by reading them. They are just so good. You just
Laura
go,
Miller, I think.
I have to read this book, or I can't read this book, or whatever it is, you know. But for some reason in crime fiction, it's like you get the little nugget, you know, you get the four sentence synopsis of the book, and well, it's like his other ones, but it's a little better, or it's sort of like his last one, but a little worse, and it's like, well, whatever. I mean, they give you these little blurbs, you know, and that's about as far as it gets. And every once in a while, I mean, a critic will dig in and write a full-sized, you know, review of one of my books, and, you know, generally they're good, sometimes they're bad, but always, I know when I read the review, I can tell you exactly in that review what's true and what's not.
Right.
When a critic says something about my work that's true, I know it. I feel it right here. I go,
you're completely right.
Yeah. You know, you are completely right. And some of those things are painful. Some of the, like, criticisms are valid, you know. Mm-hmm. I go, ooh, yeah, exactly right. And then often, though, I will read a review that's punitive, mm-hmm. but it's completely untruthful. I mean, the person has you know, misperceived the object and then attacked her own misconception. It's like, what do I have to do with this? You know, my book's like way over here and they're talking about this. You know, and so I know in my heart of hearts too, when it's bullshit and when it's punitive, and I don't have any you know, need for that. You know, I read my reviews, and I think to ignore them all is not probably, you lose a chance to learn something, because I've learned from negative reviews. I've learned things about myself that I can do better. And yet you can't just read the good ones either, because then you're deluding yourself. You know, so you guys sort of, you got to take the bad with the good. I wish that there were better mystery crime reviewers out there. I wish there were people who you could really believe them, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know.
I felt that way. Life Before Day was really, I knew that I was writing a detective mystery, or my best attempt at it. And I felt it was criticized for being a detective mystery, you know, and which was sort of like, what? You know, a little murder and, you know, the guy wants to know everything, keeps asking questions to people. It was like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
You know? And there was a sense that whatever was going on at the outlet that was reviewing it, they were passing it to the person who had maybe read Anne Rice. You know, like, they weren't passing it to anyone with a love of that genre. Or an appreciation of the genre.
Really?
That was what I came away with.
I would hate to have gone into publishing novels as you. as with my mother being, or father, whatever,
yeah.
being a hugely popular novelist. That you must have, talk about crossing the Rubicon. When you finally decided to do that, what was the conversation like?
The conversation...
Is that cool?
With her?
Yeah.
It went, Mom, yes, I've written a book. You have? When? It's Mardi Gras. When you
yeah,
write
when?
A book? She was just out of the hospital, so a little foggy, and, back from death's door. But that was her reaction. She said, wow, well, your father has to read it.
She was surprised, and she didn't know that you were doing that.
And she didn't know. So it never reached that. I think if they had hated it, it would have been a different thing.
Yeah.
They were the type of parents that would have said, Chris, let's talk about this, But they defended it, and I think they defended it because they really liked it. Or my father did. She waited to read it because she was, of course, afraid she wasn't going to like it. And when she did read it, the first book was fed by personal stuff. It was a thriller, and parts of it were very over the top, and it was the first novel, but it was fed by a lot of personal pain that caught her off guard. And so she said, were you really this, miserable in high school?
Mm-hmm.
It was like, no, not that miserable. but miserable enough.
Miserable enough.
Yeah. But, yes?
Okay, well, I'd like to thank you so much, Chris and Jeff, for your informative and engaging and revealing exchange. And please join us in the foyer for book sales and book signing. Thank you so much.
And Chris and Jeff have offered to stay and sign books. So, let's get it.
Thanks for all coming. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's good to see you guys. Good job, Mr. Rice. Are you trained
as
a journalist?
Yes, right. That's what doing this kind of stuff. That's how I got trained. Right. Uncle Bob.
That's right. Boy, those rehearsals really paid off, didn't they?
Oh, John Candy. Yeah, right.